Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, July 24th, 2014. America's death machinery has fucked it up again.
This is how it ends. I feel the chemicals burn in my bloodstream. Fading out again. I feel the chemicals burn in my bloodstream. So tell me when it kicks in.
Well, it took almost 2 hours to kick in and kill Joseph Wood in Arizona two nights ago.
Well, tell me when it kicks in. This is how it ends. I feel the chemicals burn in my bloodstream. Fading out again. I feel the chemicals burn in my bloodstream.
Our opening music from Ed Sheeran. As I mentioned yesterday, I've been kind of captivated by his music. And last night I watched television news, and then I was reading a book, and I put on this Ed Sheeran music. And this song called Bloodstream really got my attention, because just an hour before I'd been watching Rachel Maddow, who did an excellent job in a lengthy series of stories covering the botched execution. And botched is a word that has been used before, and it's kind of losing its meaning. But Arizona was so hell-bent on executing Joseph Wood that despite a Supreme Court stay that was issued, and a stay that would only be dissolved when Arizona complied with the law and released information about the drug cocktail that they were using to try to kill this man, Arizona didn't cough up that information. They didn't disclose where they got the drugs. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court dissolved its stay as this race to execute a man led to one of the most grisly scenes we have ever seen. It took nearly 2 hours for Wood to expire, so long that during that time period, they actually filed court documents asking for permission to halt the execution and revive Wood. That's how long they had. They used an experimental combination of midazolam and hydromorphone, the same drugs that were used to kill Dennis McGuire in Ohio in January. It took McGuire 26 minutes to die. Witnesses say he gasped for air and snorted loudly. Then they attempted to kill Clayton Lockett in April in the state of Oklahoma. And he writhed on the gurney before dying in an apparent heart attack after 43 minutes. So here we have two clear cases where this allegedly lethal drug concoction put these inmates through a tortuous process that ended in their deaths. And to do it again and see it take nearly 2 hours, 1 hour and 57 minutes, from the time the drugs flowed until the time he was pronounced dead. And I'm deeply opposed to the death penalty. I always have been. But if it is going to be carried out in my country, it has to be done in a way that is not obviously barbaric. And we've put the death penalty on hold here in California under a federal court order until they can sort out the issues of lethal injection. But in states with these bloodthirsty Republican governors, like Jan Brewer in Arizona, who issued a statement basically saying, oh, we're going to investigate this. It didn't look very good. But then, of course, to distract people from this barbaric act of the state, they trot out the victims, the relatives who survived the criminal acts of this man Wood. He was executed for shooting to death his girlfriend and the girlfriend's father way back in 1989. And these botched executions follow a sequence of events, including the inability of states to actually get the drugs to use to kill people. And pharmaceutical companies who don't have the highest levels of morality, you know, when it comes to charging people $1,000 a pill, say, for a hepatitis drug, even they do not want to create the pharmaceutical concoctions that are used to kill people. And so the states have gone to underhanded means to get their drugs. Isn't that, I mean, it's beyond ironic that the state is basically involved in illegal drug deals in order to execute people. So it remains to be seen if any lessons will be learned from this, because it's hard to really expect those who believe in vengeance as an expression of the law to be thinking rationally about the other issues suggested here. Coming up later in the podcast, I have a group of stories about the creeping police state in this country. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that, or fast forward if that's what you need to do. Other news before that, 10, as many as 15 people in the Gaza Strip were killed as they hunkered down in a UN-sponsored school. And this shelling led to the body count in Gaza that now is over 700 Palestinians dead, 32 Israeli soldiers, 3 Israeli civilians have been killed. And the incident today is disputed by Israel, and there is the potential here for the fog of war. But Israel says that, a statement from Brigadier General Michael Edelstein. He said, if we made a mistake, we will say it. But he said Israel was not acting intentionally against any United Nations infrastructure in Gaza. We would never bomb such a place. Only in the last 17 days, 72 United Nations schools, hospitals, and offices have been damaged in the fighting. They're visibly marked. They are noted on the maps. The Israelis know where these locations are. And Israel might have a point about the school today, but 72 other incidents involving designated locations that should be neutral and should not be subjects of attack. And so it's just a tragic situation that continues. Flights to Tel Aviv's Ben Gurion Airport have been restored. And as I mentioned yesterday, I find this bizarre that Israel, which claims 90% accuracy of its Iron Dome system, wants to bet on the lives of people flying into Tel Aviv that Hamas can't or won't or both launch a surface-to-air missile and take out a commercial airliner. Now, I certainly hope Hamas doesn't do that. But the risk is clear. And Israel wants to subject people to that risk to prove a political point. Yesterday, the United States Senate included $225 million in funding for Israel's Iron Dome rocket interception system. In the emergency funding bill that also cut $1 billion from Obama's request for $3.7 billion to deal with thousands of undocumented child immigrants. So consider the way that dollars are being horse-traded here. We cut money that Obama wanted to spend on the child and women immigrants who have swarmed to our southern border. And we're going to shift $225 million to support this Iron Dome program, and I consider it mostly to be hype. When Israel says that 90% of incoming rockets from Hamas are countered by the Iron Dome, do you really believe that? I guess you can tell that I don't. And the other thing that really bugs me is one of the frequent arguments that I have heard from conservative hypocrites in this country as to why they don't want to spend any money for humanitarian relief of those individuals who have come to our southern border. And they say, well, you know, there are millions of poor people in our country. Let's take care of Americans first. And if conservatives actually followed through and did that, their argument might carry some weight. But they are no more likely to help an inner-city, poverty-stricken child in Chicago or Detroit than they are to cough up money for humanitarian aid to the refugees on our southern border. And that rank hypocrisy really burns me. It truly does. Now, with Israel playing fast and loose with air passengers, I'll just note that we've had two more plane crashes of airliners in the last 24 hours. Near Taiwan, a TransAsia Airways prop jet carrying 58 passengers and crew crashed into a residential neighborhood in the middle of a typhoon. Now, I don't know what business they had flying in that kind of weather. And meanwhile, a jet airliner with 116 people on board disappeared overnight on a flight across the Sahara Desert from Burkina Faso to Algeria. About half the passengers are French, and it's Air Algeria's flight 5017. The plane is considered missing the last time I checked my news sources. And it's not clear, but it is expected that it crashed due to bad weather. The last time air traffic controllers were in contact with the plane, it was changing its course. And there is one eyewitness account of someone in Mali, near the border with Burkina Faso, saying they saw the plane fall from the sky about 2 o'clock in the morning. And Ukraine, the scene of last week's shootdown of the Malaysian airliner, is seeing a change of the guard. The new government there is collapsing. And some of this is predictable, but the prime minister, Yatsenyuk, has resigned as the governing coalition of the parliament has collapsed. Now, some of this is expected. It's always very fluid in Ukraine. And with the recent election of the candy billionaire Petro Poroshenko, Yatsenyuk's resignation is really a reflection of his alliance with Yulia Tymoshenko, who had challenged Poroshenko for the presidency and lost. So now they move toward early elections and a government that has even less influence and less cohesion than it did before the shootdown of the airliner last week. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work with their subscriptions, including Ray Welch, who has been a supporter for years now. I think he's one of the original subscribers when I first started podcasting about 5 years ago. And also people like Beth Daniel, Faith Peoples, Mark Brodsky. I want to thank you for your support and invite you to recruit others. I really do need help, and I don't like to sound shrill or desperate, but I need your support to continue this work. The turnover in subscriptions is a natural thing, but what it means is I have to keep getting new people in to replace the people who leave. And my net revenues haven't increased much over the last year, so I'm still kind of treading water here and struggling to pay all the bills. So I'd appreciate it if you sign up today. Come on over to peterbcollins.com under my picture on the homepage. You click sign up. That takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever's best for you. And the best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD with political themes called Red Flag. And I have a few more bags of kick-ass Kona coffee to send your way. Another change of the guard, this time in Iraq. And it does seem that they're trying to build more of a coalition government. But I think it's probably too late. I think the partitioning is too far down the road. But Iraq's leaders have selected a Kurdish leader named Fuad Masum to be the figurehead president of the country. It's the prime minister who runs things. And, of course, al-Maliki, Nouri al-Maliki, is clinging to power there, despite calls from all quarters, including recently from Iran, that he step down. But he is kind of doubling down. And the other development is last week, the parliament elected a moderate Sunni Islamist to the position of speaker. And that means we've got a speaker who is a Sunni, we've got a president who's a Kurd, and a prime minister who's a Shiite. Now, that is the kind of coalition or unity government that outsiders have been calling for. But given the gains that the Islamic State has made in recent weeks, I'm hard-pressed to see that it will make much of a difference. Now to our reports on the national surveillance and creeping police state here in the United States. There's a new whistleblower named John Napier Tye, spelled T-Y-E. He was at the State Department until he left in, I think, April of this year. And he wrote an op-ed that was published last week that draws attention to the legal basis for the surveillance of innocent Americans. And one of the legal foundations is an obscure executive order that was signed by Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s called Executive Order 12333. And this surfaces in some of the debate over the NSA, in some of the documents that were released by Ed Snowden. And this man, Tye, says that without reform of activities under 12333, changes to the 215 program, that's the Patriot Act, a records collection clause, won't address the major challenges to Americans' privacy from NSA. Without using Snowden's documents, Tye said that 12333 provides NSA with a pathway to collect and retain Americans' data without a warrant. The only real restrictions, he said, are that the collection must occur outside the borders of the United States. And this is where the alliance with the other members of the so-called Five Eyes come in. For example, you get New Zealand to grab a certain piece of information or a phone call. And under Section 12333, if that was legally collected offshore, then the NSA can see it and use it. It's a huge loophole and end run. But it's also one of the issues that was raised by Ed Snowden in the single email that the NSA has released. Remember that? Snowden queried somebody in Fort Meade asking about whether a statute, a law passed by Congress, takes precedence over an executive order. And most likely, that's why Ed Snowden was asking about that. So this is very interesting, and we'll see if anything results from it. We haven't seen much appetite lately for real reform. But in the state of Missouri, the Show Me State, voters will go to the polls on August 5th and take a look at Amendment 9. And I support this based on what I've seen. Amendment 9 would give electronic data and communications the same state constitutional protections as persons, homes, papers, and effects. This would eliminate any constitutional ambiguity surrounding electronic data and specifically bar state agencies from accessing it without a warrant in most cases. By prohibiting state agents from accessing warrantless electronic data, it would make such data gathered by federal agencies like NSA and shared with state and local law enforcement inadmissible in state criminal proceedings. So this is a fascinating and intelligent nullification of federal powers for residents of the state of Missouri. And if you live in the Show Me State, hey, show me. Show me that you go to the polls and vote to approve that on August 5th. Today, we release an in-depth interview to our subscribers at peterbcollins.com with Al Jazeera America reporter Trevor Aronson and his senior producer on the investigative team, Jeremy Young. I will put up a link in this podcast and also the interview podcast so that you can go to Al Jazeera and watch this one-hour video documentary. It's very powerful, and it profiles three different paid FBI informants. One of them infiltrated the so-called Liberty City 7 in Miami, Florida, and Trevor Aronson describes what went on there with this paid informant.
Back in 2006, I was working as a reporter in Miami and heard about the Liberty City 7 case. And this was a case of seven men who had no connections to Al-Qaeda, had no weapons, and really had very limited economic resources. They were in one of the poorest sections of Miami. And Ali Assad, who calls himself the closer, prides himself on the fact that he will go in and make good a case that a government informant or an undercover agent had not been able to move forward. And he's the one that went in and was able to get the Liberty City 7 to pledge an oath to Al-Qaeda in this very cartoonish fashion. And prosecutors would use that at trial to show that these men were committed to getting involved in a conspiracy to support Al-Qaeda. At the same time, though, as we show in our documentary, Ali Assad moved over to El Paso, was convicted of beating his wife, led police in El Paso on a high-speed chase, was convicted of DUI, and in general was committing crimes while he was working as a government informant. And what's not unique about that is the fact that many informants are criminals.
You can hear the full interview with Trevor Aronson and Jeremy Young. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. One of my other podcasts called Processing Distortion is available today over at boilingfrogspost.com. I interviewed scrappy reporter Yasha Levine. He writes for Pando Daily. And he's been on with me before to talk about the collusion between Google and the spy community. And in a recent report, he exposed that the Tor encryption system, which has been touted by Ed Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, was developed and deployed by the United States government, by DARPA and the Naval Research Lab. And its primary purpose is to serve members of the intelligence community. That's not the way it's presented to American consumers and privacy advocates. And in this excerpt from our in-depth interview, Yasha Levine explains why they wanted public members and non-spooks to use Tor.
You know, so these researchers who were working out of the U.S. Naval Lab in Washington, D.C., you know, pretty quickly figured out that creating a technical system of anonymity is not enough. You need to actually create a system where there is a crowd that's big enough that can hide of just all sorts of uses. You know, people just who are afraid for their privacy and just use it for just their daily browsing activity. You know, people who don't want their, you know, someone at home finding out that they are, you know, gay or you know, like a certain type of porn. They, you know, people who are just, you know, afraid of disclosing their medical information to Google, mm-hmm. And they don't want that link to their identity. You want to have, you know, hackers, you know, terrorists, doesn't matter, criminals, you know, child pornographers. As the widest and diverse of a group of users as you can get it, you know, hides spooks better. And mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it's like a big busy plaza, you know, and just a lot of people are out there. And so if you just have one spook walking around, you know, he can hide in plain sight in the crowd. And so that's what Tor is. It's like this, it needs the crowd.
The full interview with Pando's Yasha Levine is available today for subscribers at BoilingFrogsPost.com. And my last item for the creeping national security police state is a new article from Jeremy Scahill and Ryan Devereaux, published at The Intercept. And they got a hold of a copy of the rule book that the government uses for defining and deciding who gets on the various terrorist watch lists and no-fly lists. And as we've discussed before, once you get on the list, even if it was done incorrectly and inaccurately, it's very hard to get off. We have the case of a Malaysian woman, or Indonesian, I can't recall. She was studying at Stanford. And when she went home for the holidays, she found out she was on a no-fly list, and she has no connection to terrorism. She is sued to get her name off the list, and the court was about to order that when secret information from the government was provided, and the judge, didn't go forward with that ruling. So Scahill does a good job of explaining the rules that the government says they follow. And the bottom line is that if you get placed on the terrorist watch list, well, you will never know why, and getting off that list is virtually impossible. And the threshold of suspicion you know required to put someone on the list is extremely low. And so there's great detail in this article, and I invite you to read it for yourself. But what we learn from it is that this is a system without checks and balances. There's nobody you can go to and say, I don't belong on the no-fly list, take my name off it. And there are actually two different lists, one that's managed by the FBI. And it's not known if there's any real coordination between the compilation of the lists. There's also a classified database that gets, declassified. They take out some of the sensitive information. But the bottom line is, if you're on this list, the people who use it to investigate you or to deny you access to an airplane flight, they can't even tell you why you're on the list. So finally today, I have a couple of emails that have come in from listeners I wanted to respond to. The other day, I was talking about presidential overreach on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and that, in my view, Republicans have a legitimate gripe that the president has unilaterally changed elements of a law that was passed by Congress. And as I've pointed out, the presidential overreach to me is much more critical on domestic surveillance, on the president's assertion that he has the authority to order people killed, like Anwar al-Awlaki. And so in the big scheme of things, his overreach on Obamacare, to me, doesn't rise to the impeachment level. But it is a legitimate issue. And Gary Kane in Fairlawn, New Jersey writes, Hi, Peter. Regarding presidential overreach on ACA, is this the right battle for you to wage? The overreach, assuming you're correct, expands health insurance coverage to millions of middle-class and poor Americans. It's not for corporate welfare or restriction of constitutional rights. Compared to W's overreach with Alberto Gonzalez. Perhaps you can pass on this issue for the benefit of millions of Americans getting insurance coverage. Pick a more egregious issue. Well, Gary, I call him as I see him. And I don't agree with you that the presidential overreach is benign. And by, for example, delaying the corporate mandate, it really punched a hole in the economics of Obamacare. And this overreach cements the profiteering of the health insurance companies who enjoy federal subsidies to underwrite the coverage of millions of Americans. And I'm not going to pass on this issue because the millions of Americans that Gary is talking about would all be better off with single payer, with Medicare for all. And finally today, a number of people have responded to my request the other day because I hate the name Department of Homeland Security, and I'd like to rename it. We have a couple of submissions. One is from Peanut in the Peanut Gallery, who suggests Homeland. I'm sure there's some homeboys who would like that and some others who might not. And then Edie from Atlanta writes, I cringe every time I hear Department of Homeland Security. Ugh. It reminds me of Der Vaterland, and I expect goose-stepping down the street at any moment. I saw an old movie called Ministry of Fear, and that pops into my head now and then. How about Department of Mind Your Own Fucking Business? Hope somebody can do something, can come up with something better. Department of Ice Cream, or Home Department, or Home and Hearth Department. Well, Edie, keep working on it. Get back to me when you have a real gem, okay? Thanks one and all for listening to my ranting and raving here on the Peter B. Collins News and Comment Podcast. This one is absolutely free, and you're authorized to share it everywhere. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until